All right, I'd like to call this hearing of the Health, Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good afternoon, everybody. I would just like to remind members to keep your feeds muted and use the raise your hand function when you would like to ask a question, and then staff will put your hand down again. So we will start with the roll call, and you just can, when your name is called, just say, present.
Lee Blaine.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Present.
Becker. Becker. I see your name up. I know you're there.
Backer, present. We're just working on a new computer.
Okay. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth. Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Heal. Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Pryor. Kwong.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Okay, and Ms. Niedernhofer, could you just call the ones who didn't answer? Because I think people might have had technical issues here.
Bonner.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Heal. Pryor. Those were the ones who weren't.
Okay, a quorum is present. And let's see, Representative Hewitt will move the minutes of January 13th, 2021.
Madam Chair, so moved.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none. If you would unmute yourselves, we'll just take a voice vote to approve the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you, members. So the first thing in our agenda for today is an overview from Results First, which is a which lives in the Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm going to, without further ado, turn it over to Patrick Carter. Mr. Carter, I saw you on here somewhere. And thank you for being with us. If you would introduce yourself and tell folks what Results First is and just go ahead and give your presentation. Thanks.
Sounds great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for having me here today. Again, I'm Patrick Carter from the results management team at Minnesota Management and Budget. We're a part of the budget division at MMB. And our goal is to help inform decision-making processes with data and research on outcomes for Minnesotans. We're nonpartisan staff and value objectivity and transparency in our work. We believe that policymakers and administrators want to operate and fund programs that produce desired outcomes. There are lots of anecdotes and assumptions about what works. However, increasingly scientific evidence is available to indicate a given program has produced the desired results. So today I'll talk a little bit about our program, some of the work we've done, and then provide you with some resources for you to use.
And Mr. Carter, if I could just stop for 1 second, I probably, in order to sort of focus members' attention on this a little bit more, I probably should just mention, this is something that we did in the last term in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. And I'm going to be asking members, when you bring a bill before the committee, I'm going to be asking you before you do that to consult results first. And when you make your bill presentation, to let the committee know whether results first has information that can inform the thing that you're bringing before the committee. So that's what I would like you to be, why I want you to pay attention to what Mr. Carter is presenting. And hopefully at the end of his presentation, you'll understand a little bit more what I'm asking you to do. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start out with a non-policy anecdote that might give you a sense of a real-world example of the work that we do in your everyday life, and hopefully you can translate that to the work that you're doing at the legislature. So let's say you're considering buying a new light bulb. You have one that works, but you might want to buy a new one. How do you know if there's a better one out there? You could trust the seller. You could read information on the package of the new light bulb. Maybe a friend made a recommendation. You could search the internet for reviews, maybe consult Consumer Reports or Wirecutter, something like that. Each of these relies on different sources and methods to gather information, and each one will have different benefits and blind spots as you're choosing to buy that light bulb. You can use them in combination with each other as well. Our work is similar to Consumer Reports. Consumer Reports provides an independent review of how those light bulbs perform. They can test those light bulbs side by side and put them through years of testing that one person couldn't do on their own. However, instead of light bulbs, we're sharing information on programs and policies that have been evaluated in a systematic way. The primary difference with this analogy is that we only indicate if a policy is proven or promising if it has been studied using high quality, rigorous scientific methods. Using evidence-based programs is not the only way to know that programs should be funded, but we believe it's an important one that mitigates potential pitfalls of relying on anecdotes or less rigorous research methods. Even if you don't use Consumer Reports for buying light bulbs in your personal life, when making multi-million dollar decisions, we believe it's important to know what works. And the resources that I'll be talking about today will hopefully give you the tools to be able to do that. So a little bit about Results First. In 2015, the legislature created the Results First initiative at MMB in partnership with the Pew and MacArthur Foundation to begin by looking at human services and criminal justice programs. Since then, Minnesota has been recognized for its work in the space. Most recently, this last year, Results for America recognized Minnesota as a leading example for evaluation policies and defining evidence and inventorying programs. Even with this recognition, there's still many opportunities to use evidence in the policymaking process. Our team's goal is to produce evidence-based information that's understood, trusted, and used. So far, we have compiled reports in 8 different areas that you can see on your screen right here, and we have 2 underway. We have a wide variety of stakeholders. In addition to the legislative branch, there's also advisors in the executive branch, tribal and county representatives, and representation from the judicial branch. And we also work hand in hand with community partners and service providers who are implementing these programs. So as I alluded to in my example, when we talk about evidence, we have a pretty high standard for what that means. So it's important to have some boundaries when we talk about what we mean by evidence. In many cases, when you hear about how a program is doing, you may get the information that's portrayed on your screen here. There were 80 people looking for work, and 4 of them found work after the intervention. This, however, is only a portion of the scientific approach to understanding whether or not an intervention works. Ideally, you would take 80 people, randomly assign them to 2 groups. One gets the intervention and one does not get the intervention. And then you find out how both of those groups fared. In this case, 20 people in the control group found a job and 40 people in the intervention group. In many cases for government programs, it's not ethical or logistically appropriate to randomly assign people. But the same concept can be done statistically. Scientists use variety of robust approaches to approximate the randomization and control and intervention group. So when we say something's proven, that means that it has a positive impact that's been demonstrated through multiple rigorous evaluations. When something is promising, a single randomized controlled trial or evaluation that's rigorous has said that it has a positive impact. When we say something is theory-based, it means that it doesn't have any rigorous research. This is sort of a neutral review. It doesn't mean that it's good or bad. It's just there is no rigorous research that we can find for a particular program. There's a variety of other ratings as well. Mixed effects, meaning that there's contradictory effects found in the research of that high quality evidence. No effect means that one of those rigorous studies found that there's no statistically significant impact of that program on the outcomes. And a proven harmful one says that the program has been demonstrated to have negative effects on the individuals participating in that program. So with just a brief orientation to those levels of evidence, I'll talk through what we found so far and what's in the Minnesota inventory. So we've taken a look at over 550 programs that are happening within Minnesota, and we've compiled them using existing evidence to support their effectiveness in a public-facing database that I'll show you shortly. About half of the programs that we looked at are theory-based, again, that neutral rating where we weren't able to find any high-quality evidence indicating what the outcomes are for those programs. About 25% have been proven effective, meaning that there's multiple rigorous evaluations for those programs. About 20% are promising, meaning that there's one scientific study documenting the outcomes. And the remaining 5% have been demonstrated to have no effect, mixed effect, or other. So let's talk about how you can use this information. This is, as I mentioned, the Minnesota inventory. So this is 550 of those programs that I just mentioned. And there's a variety of ways that you can use this tool. I tend to think of two major paths. The first is if you receive the name of a program that's happening in Minnesota from a colleague or a constituent or from an agency, you can pull that program name up if we've looked in those areas and see what its evidence rating is. Alternatively, if you're looking to potentially expand a program or maybe your local county commissioner is looking for a solution for a particular issue, you can also narrow down your search by outcomes, population, and setting. So, for example, if you were looking to reduce alcohol consumption in minors, you could check the appropriate boxes on the screen here, and it would show you what programs are happening in Minnesota that affect those outcomes. In a similar way, if there is a program that isn't happening in Minnesota right now, we rely heavily on national clearinghouses, one of which is the Pew Foundation's clearinghouse that I have shown on the screen right here. There's over 3,000 programs listed in this database. And again, you can use it in a similar fashion. If you have the name, you can pull it up and find out what the evidence basis is for that program. Or if you're looking for particular outcomes or in particular categories or settings, you can also search those to find, if you're looking to find a program that will achieve your desired outcome. So here's a quick rundown of some of the resources. There's also a handout that was included in today's materials that provides these links as well as some additional resources. This was obviously a really quick overview of our work and the tools that you can use in your decision making, and I'm glad to answer any questions that that all of you have.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Mr. Carter. I see that Representative Quam has his hand up. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I had to switch out of the display of his desktop to be able to unmute myself. Some of these programs, when you're showing that they're in effect in Minnesota, is there a geo or a state map showing what areas of the state have the program active? Because some of the things I understand are regionally implemented, especially test cases.
Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, great question. So when I was talking through the Minnesota inventory, the 550 programs that we've taken a look at, in some cases, these exist only at a county or a couple of counties. In some cases, they're large statewide programs. I should note that in some cases, the evidence that we found, the existing evidence for these programs comes from Minnesota, but in a lot of cases, it comes from outside of the state where another state is operating a program just like that. To answer your question specifically, Representative, we don't necessarily have a map showing where each program is operating, but if you're interested in finding out the sources of the information for a particular program, we can pull that up or work with the relevant department to find out where that's happening within the state.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Many times we've done pilot programs such as in Rochester and Olmsted. We did one with expectant mothers, and it'd be nice to understand where, you know, if we want to expand or if they've tried a test somewhere. But thank you for the information.
Right. Thank you, Representative Quam. And, you know, just to put a point on it, members, this doesn't tell you everything you'd ever want to know about each of these programs. The point of this database is to try to collect evidence about outcomes, how well the programs work. And it's not all inclusive. I think, as Mr. Carter has said, you know, it only contains, I mean, there is really probably an unlimited number of programs that could be evaluated. It's constantly growing. But it is a tool that we can use probably better than we have. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I'm clear, I mean, I guess this question's for Mr. Carter. You're using the term program a lot. You know, I tend to think of that as, you know, some office or, you know, something requiring some staff, people to be set up to administer some sort of service. You know, this is also a policy committee. So some of the things we're discussing are just pure policy changes that may not actually involve, you know, staff or funding something. Do you look at those as well, or only existing programs that have staff and provide some sort of a service?
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, great question. When we use the term program, I think it varies by who our audience is. In some cases, it would be a service. In some cases, it could be an intervention. And in some cases, it is, as you mentioned, a policy. So I think if you were to look at the inventory or the Pew Foundation clearinghouse, you would see things in there that fall into each of those categories.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And we're going to need to move on. Oh, I see. Representative Bierman has a question. And then go ahead, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to be clear on if we have something that we want to investigate, a bill that we're thinking about, what are the steps to reach out and contact MMB for gathering information, or are we supposed to do this on our own, so to speak, see what applies? How does the system work?
Great question. Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. So the information that we've linked here is publicly available, and you're able to pursue that at your leisure. Our team is also available if you don't find information on there, or you need help finding information for a concept or a bill that you're working on. We'd be glad to work with members in finding out what evidence basis exists for that program.
Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, just to follow up then, is there somewhere in the document that we're looking at here today how to reach out to contact?
Yeah, so Representative Bierman, so the slides, I believe we would have received them in our inboxes, so you should have these. And then there's, you basically just go to the website.
Okay.
So it's all there, and I really would recommend that members spend some time just looking through it. It really is very fascinating.
Sure.
So, and so just in terms of my expectations for the committee, realizing that not everything that you're going to be working on is going to be on results first. Some things, as Representative Freiberg was talking about, it may be a policy, something they haven't dealt with. You know, it may not exactly fit, but what I would like to do is just to get members in the habit of looking at results first. And then just when you bring your bill, if you could just tell the committee, I looked at results first, this really doesn't fit there, they don't have anything like it, or I saw something, you know, just to tell us that you looked and what did you find? And what you found might not be anything relevant. On the other hand, it might be very relevant. I have one final question for Mr. Carter, and that is, if we are become aware of a new program or a new policy of some kind, and it's not listed in results first, is there a procedure to begin the investigation of that policy or program?
Madam Chair, just so I understand your question, if a new program is created that's not already in the inventory, is there a way to add it to the inventory?
Correct, or just to have something investigated that isn't in the inventory, whether it's a specific program or something we read about in another state or anything new that's not there.
Yep. So if there are things happening in Minnesota that are not in the inventory that you would like added, we would you can reach out. Our contact information is on the handout, or staff has my email. You can reach out directly to me as well, and we can do the review and add it to the Minnesota inventory. If there's something happening in another state or you're considering a bill, you can reach out in a similar way, and we would be glad to work with you to find out what the evidence basis is for that program.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Carter. Really appreciate it. I know it's a very small office, and I know at least part of your staff has been pulled away on COVID duty like so many other people, but we appreciate your continued work and hope to make use of the inventory this session. So
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we will move on then. We have a presentation from, we're going to start with Stefan Gildemeister from the Department of Health, talking to us about healthcare spending during COVID. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gildemeister.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bringing up my presentation. And while I do that, again, thank you for inviting me to the committee, for asking me to present some updated information on healthcare spending in Minnesota. I have a brief slide deck that I'll walk through. But for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm the state health economist. I'll take a tiny look back and then mostly a look not so far back to walk through the information you asked about. So to jump right in, the health department tracks healthcare spending in Minnesota, which is, of course, price of healthcare services times a mix of services times volume for the whole population. So when we think about healthcare spending, we think about it generally for the whole population, then we can break it down farther. But we do that through a number of data sources and a number of publications. And as part of our work, we issue an annual report to the legislature that consists of a walkthrough about who how does Minnesota spend healthcare dollars? Who pays for these? Where do these dollars come from? How have things been changing? What are the trends? And then we look to project future healthcare spending. And then at times we look at other features or categories of spending, like low-value care or chronic disease spending, or spending in the individual market, to provide you additional insights in the work that you conduct. At a high level, typically what we find from this work is that despite sort of years of attempts to limit healthcare spending growth, it really has continued unabatedly. And healthcare spending growth in most years tend to outpace economic process, income growth among individuals, and inflation. And this is just a screenshot of some data that we've produced in the past. So on the top left panel, you see growth in healthcare spending represented in billion dollars. At the bottom, you see year over year change in these total healthcare spending. And then on the right panel, you see the distribution of healthcare services, as well as how they've been growing over time. In addition to these data, we tend to look at spending as a share of the economy. How much of the economy do we devote for healthcare? How much out-of-pocket spending exists, and much, much more. But I know you don't want me to dwell on outdated data. We're working right now to update these data to 2019, but you're really interested in what transpired in 2020. And that's why I want to go next. But I want to preface this by saying that we won't nearly have answers to the most important questions, likely for a number of years, to have a clear understanding. But what I want to show you are some initial trends that you may find useful. Much of this is coming from national data, which has become available in some instances. At a high level, Minnesota healthcare spending appears to be affected by a number of main factors, many of which were most severely felt in the second quarter of 2020. So first of all, patients avoided and delayed care because of concern over exposure to the virus in the healthcare setting, or because of restrictions associated with elective procedures. So the volume of healthcare, the volume of visits likely was down, and we expect to see that in healthcare spending. There's also evidence that this change in healthcare use reached into preventive healthcare services, including childhood vaccination, but also other categories. So these are a range of services that would have declined in volume relative to previous years. But there are also a number of structural changes that likely occurred at around the same time or impacted by the direct or indirect effects of the pandemic. First of all, there were certainly additional services for the diagnosis and treatment of COVID-19 among patients, but also care systems responded to the economic and clinical demands on them by reorganizing and restructuring care delivery, including by reducing staff and at some in some circumstances closing sites of care. But if we sort of and while ambulatory visits primarily declined relative to earlier years, there was a pretty substantial increase in telemedicine services that we would have observed, and I'll show some context for that in a moment. But on balance, as we think sort of about the impact of COVID-19, sort of the initial research seems to indicate that the COVID-19 related spending increases, so the diagnosis and the treatment, people who were hospitalized or required other support services, was more than offset by the reductions in spending for non-COVID-19 services. In other words, we expect there to be a decline in spending in 2019, or at least a sort of more of a decline in some services than an increase in other services. So I wanted to illustrate this now with a few numbers that we were able to pull together. So regarding my earlier point, well, let me start with a circle on the top panel. So these are data through the third quarter of 2020. This is from national estimates. And what this tells us is that healthcare spending was down about 2.4%. It's not the whole story, of course, because you would expect healthcare spending to increase between 3 to 5, 6%. So the impact in 2019, even though this is not a complete set of data yet, but the impact is pretty substantial as measured by the change in healthcare spending. And then in looking at the lower panel, most of the impact that we would have seen to date, again, not counting the fourth quarter, which of course was substantially disruptive, most of the decline occurred in the second quarter. And that's what you are able to see here in this lower panel by a decline of, it's hard to see, 8% or so, 9%. The experience in the change in healthcare spending year over year really differs by areas of all categories of healthcare services. But there may be a number of points to take away from this data, which is also drawn from national trends. So first of all, these data compare spending through various months compared to the equivalent month the previous year. And what you can see here that by April, there was substantial declines in healthcare services relative to April 2019 for hospital services and physician and clinical care, about 40%. Dental services fell as much as 70% by that time. And though healthcare use increased towards the end of the year, what you see on the right-hand side are the percentages through October by which estimates for 2020 differ from the previous year. So with the exception of home care and prescription drugs, where spending increased relative to the previous year by 14% and 3%, all other categories of services have experienced a decline. So what you're seeing here is some offsetting dynamics. So prescription drugs, not much affected by 2020, which makes sense. Much of prescribing happens electronically, and accessing prescription drugs doesn't always require, at least maintenance drugs, doesn't always require a visit. Nursing home care, of course, fell because of the huge impact of the pandemic on long-term settings, but it was offset by, to some extent, by home health spending, which increased 14% by October of 2020.
Mr. Gildemeister, there is a question from Representative Pryor. So, members, I guess what I would ask you to do, if I'm going to call on Representative Pryor, but if you have clarifying questions, please do raise your hand, and then otherwise, after her question, we'll just put you on the list, and then when Mr. Gildemeister is done with his getting through his slides, then we'll call on people for more in-depth questions. So, Representative Pryor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, great. Technology, still working with it today. My question is, looking at this chart about where the reductions have been and knowing that it's that the nursing care, and that's where COVID is, as we all know, has hit the hardest. Do you see that as being, is that going to be just a temporary, is the belief? Or has actually that population, has there been a significant enough change in kind of our mortality rates in Minnesota that this may actually be be part of our permanent picture going forward?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Madam Chair and Representative Pryor, it's such an important question that you're asking, and I am far from an expert in the area of long-term care, and I know there are experts on the call, so I'll limit myself in my response. I think, first of all, of course, you're right that the impact of COVID-19 on clients in nursing homes was devastating and continues to be devastating. Immense loss of life and even quality of life associated with patients who died while in their 70s, 80s, or 90s. But I think one of the at least there's the expectation that the pandemic taught us something about healthy and good lives at a time where we may require some form of support services, whether that is in nursing homes or through home health services in families or in other settings. And I think it is too early to know what the answer will be. But I think one thing is clear, and I feel that is true for many parts of my presentation, though we don't have the answers. What we are learning is that the pandemic has shown us some weaknesses of the system that represents an opportunity to think through how we may want to restructure, refinance, and reorganize access to services, affordability of services, and how services are delivered to individuals and their families. So I don't mean that to be a non-answer other than to say it's too early, we don't know, but clearly there is something to learn from the pandemic that ought to have long-term consequences.
Thank you. And Representative Pryor, I actually have some further data on this that I have gotten from DHS, who really would be the entity that could answer this probably more fully. And I'll share that with the committee, because I did ask for some data on what has been happening specifically in nursing homes. So please continue, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I mentioned earlier that we've seen worrisome declines in preventive care as sort of part of the general decline in healthcare services. This is also data from a national analysis of claims data. And what you're seeing here with these various lines representing in dark orange, childhood immunization, in red, colonoscopies, and in lighter orange, obesity counseling, a huge decline in these services or demand of these services in the second quarter. And though there has been increase towards the end of the year, as we've seen for the other services as well, I think clinicians and public health experts expect 2020 to be a year where we've fallen far behind in accessing the necessary services that help us stay healthy and help children to stay healthy as well. So one of the worrisome trends that I think has come out of our observation that healthcare use has fallen. In a bit of maybe good news, at least on balance, I would say, though ambulatory visits have declined so substantially and still haven't reached pre-COVID levels, what we have seen is that the decline in office visits in part were offset by telehealth visits. So visits that are that come to be through technology like video conferencing or the kind of thing that we're doing here, I suppose. So on the left-hand side, on the left panel, you see absolute visits in millions for the U.S. And you see the in green the increase in the telehealth visits primarily through April, May and June that since has declined. And then on the right-hand side, we see the distribution of ambulatory visits spread between office visits and telehealth visits. And it's really stunning to me how even with the financing and the reimbursement that's begun to be made available by Medicare and Medicaid for telehealth services, how a little telehealth was part of healthcare consumption through the beginning of the pandemic, but then how it exploded virtually, comprising in April almost 70% of visits, and then falling to what is a pretty substantial 20% of visits towards the end of the summer. So this is a really important question, but it's also one of the questions that I'll queue up in the end to sort of say, we just don't know enough what this means for spending and what this means for quality of care. I wanted to take a minute to look at some Minnesota data that we have access to. This comes from Minnesota's individual market. We've drawn this from data from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And each of these families of bars represent visits or encounters that are physician or non-physician visits, hospital days, and then at the bottom, inpatient admissions. And you see through the third quarter that for most of these categories, utilization really has fallen substantially in the second and the third quarter, with one exception, inpatient admissions per 100 people, which increased in the second quarter in Minnesota's individual market. This is likely related to the pandemic that brought people to the hospital, but nevertheless, sort of this mirrors the picture of changes in utilization that we see at the national level. And there's no reason to believe that the data that I showed you earlier is not what we will see once Minnesota data becomes available more consistently. Sort of for many carriers, partly in response to the lower utilization, these carriers have issued premium holidays or discounts in 2021 and 2020, recognizing that they had fewer outlays for healthcare use. And I suppose that the COVID-related costs, which were sometimes borne by state and federal funds, did not offset these lower spending. So we don't have a very consistent overview of these data, but this has been drawn from press releases that have emerged over 2020 from Blue Cross, UCare, UnitedHealth, and Health Partners. It, I think, is too early to know how this would play out in terms of 2021. Healthcare utilization. This is one of the, I think, big questions that that we just need more time to better understand. On slide 13, and I apologize that I've not noted this for those of you who are following along. Just like the private market, Minnesota state public programs also have seen lower healthcare utilization in 2020 and sort of expect to see reductions in spending over the next 2 years, resulting from these lower base levels of utilization in 2021. And in the forecast, you'll find about $400 million lower projected spending for state public programs. This is not the full picture, but I think Commissioner Anderson plans on sketching this out for you with, of course, greater content knowledge and superior wit than I could bring to this topic. So I'll move on from here to some concluding thoughts. Clearly, the direct and indirect effects of the pandemic really represented a devastating shock to our lives, the economy, and people's well-being. The healthcare system has, of course, been on the front lines of the pandemic and has not been left untouched either. Utilization for preventive services fell, for all services fell, but including for preventive services. So there's a discontinuity of care that I think many are observing. The number of providers and sites through which they deliver care have contracted. At the same time, providers had to readjust and make new investments, deliver care in settings that represented much greater infection control. But overall, I think the pandemic has identified a number of weaknesses that are important for us to think about as we think about the opportunities for reimagining healthcare where we can make improvement. And I'll say a few words on the weaknesses, at least as they represent themselves to me. Much of health insurance coverage in Minnesota and MDH is working on providing you an update on that, but much of coverage is really based on employer care. And as we are going through economic downturns, we've seen that through the Great Recession, those mean oftentimes a reduction in employer-based insurance coverage, a disruption of services, but then also a disruption in healthcare, into the healthcare system, sort of unanticipated decline in revenues and restructuring how care is delivered. Similarly, where healthcare is delivered through fee-for-service settings, as services decline, you know, revenue falls in parallel ways and creates a substantial disruption to systems that sort of are very labor intensive and also capital intensive. There have been persistent inequities by race and ethnicity in the society, and they've been mirrored, of course, in the healthcare system. What we have seen through the pandemic is that these inequities have created a lack of trust between among people of color and American Indians and the healthcare system. And that's, of course, been so damaging during the pandemic as we're thinking about the need for adequate testing in all communities, the need for isolation or quarantine, and for seeking care at appropriate times. Public health is fractured, and I don't say that just because I work for the health department. It's been a really hard lift, of course, for all of public health, not just the state health department, and has made it very difficult to adequately respond to a pandemic. So we ought to probably think about how we think about the trade-offs between acute care and preventive or public health care. And then and collectively, I'd say we've struggled with risk communication, health literacy, and a lack of shared understanding about facts. And that's really made it difficult it's created confusion, made it difficult for patients to know where in the pandemic we were and what is appropriate and adequate behavior and how to seek healthcare. But the bottom line is there are really strong indications that healthcare spending will decline for the first time in many years in 2020. And though that is a pretty solid fact, I think there are numerous aspects of the pandemic and its impact that we just won't understand for a long time because we haven't seen data and it has to play out sort of in the population. So here are some examples. It's not an exhaustive list, but we need to understand how care avoidance and delayed care has translated in terms of health and well-being and to what extent pent-up demand will emerge to solve this or will emerge sort of as a spending factor that we need to be aware of. Representative Pryor spoke about mortality. There's been immense excess mortality, something that is measurable in terms of life years lost. We need to understand what the long-term consequences are, both for spending, but also for populations and families. The morbid reality of healthcare spending calculations is when people don't age into older years, our healthcare cost will decline. That's not something that we want to take to the bank, of course, but that's something that we want to think about in terms of maybe restructuring or reimagining healthcare. There's a lot of talk about the new normal, and I will talk about it a little bit as well. We need to understand the appropriate place and benefit of telemedicine in healthcare, both from the patient perspective of convenience, from the perspective of continuity of care, but also how it sort of relates to quality of care and healthcare spending. Will telemedicine just add to healthcare spending or really replace the trip to a office or a clinic. And then, you know, how will the delivery system emerge, and when will it emerge from the pandemic, and what will it look like then? What does it mean for access across the state, where we already experience access barriers in some instances? And then, you know, what has the pandemic taught us individually about health and the trade-offs that we make sort of on a daily basis? But I want to leave you with sort of a sense of optimism to remind us that a crisis are opportunities to reimagine systems, identify its weaknesses, and look forward to it, a better way of serving the public and Minnesota residents. And with that, thank you for your time. I'm happy to see if I can answer any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Gildemeister. You know, we are about 5 minutes over on his presentation, and we do have one more. So if we have just a quick question and a quick answer, then I think we'll go on to Mr. Anderson. So Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can get the answers offline, and possibly it can be distributed to the community. The touching on the effect of telemedicine, but the accessibility to the different populations that have less accessibility, and the discussion of bifurcation of rates, the decreased spending on diagnostic, is there a projection of the future expenses that might come from the lack of the diagnostics? And you touched on the increase, the mortality. Well, the increased impact of the mortality of high-risk pools, how is that changing and shifting your modeling? And then is there an anticipated increase in the birth rate? And then we need some discussion separately in the future on dental networks, because I'm concerned of the deterioration of the programs that we've got for the lower-income people. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's a lot of questions, and I don't think we'll have time to get those answers right now, but there is a whole lot to think about here. And just touching on one of those issues, Representative Kwan and others, the telehealth piece, that is going to be a big topic this session. So stay tuned. This will not be the last opportunity to discuss all of these things. And I do just want to tell folks, too, that the Department of Health has in the healthcare economics, the section that Mr. Gildemeister heads up, is has just tremendous data on its website. So it's really worth going there and just looking at what they have. I always find that really instructive too. So Mr. Gildemeister, thank you so much. Do you want to take any little stab at that? I do want to get to Commissioner Anderson, but do you want to just answer a bit?
Yeah, those are big questions, and Representative Kwan, we'll get back to you. Just wanted to assure you that however complicated it is, we are in our 2019 update, which we hope to issue over the summer of 2020, we are beginning to think about what the predicted forecasts are. It will be for 2020 and in the future on some of the dynamics, but so little is known, it'll be a real challenge, and we'll probably be wrong, just as many forecasts are in hindsight.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. We really appreciate you pulling this together for us. We know you, like the rest of your agency, are extremely busy. So thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So we're going to turn now to Matt Anderson, Assistant Commissioner from Healthcare Administration, Department of Human Services. Assistant Commissioner.
Hello, Chair Liebling, thank you. And thank you, committee, for having me here today. Appreciate the opportunity to listen to both the MMB presentation as well as the Department of Health presentation. I do want to warn you in advance that Mr. Gildemeister's reference to my wit is grossly overstated. Apologize for that, but he likes setting me up and then watching as I squirm. So as he indicated, we have for our medical assistance in Minnesota care programs have been trying to track and do some of the same complicated analysis that he's able to do. Our actuaries have been working, and it's been a wild year for them. Representative Quam, in respect to the questions that you asked, those are exactly the challenges that our actuaries are trying to struggle with about how we predict how the effects of the pandemic on multiple levels may be affecting our enrollees and healthcare spending going forward. So we have a few slides that I'm going to try to go through and hopefully have time for questions as well. And Bobst is with me today to help manage the slides for me, and appreciate her help with that. So let's go to the second slide. Just as a quick overview, medical assistance, which is Minnesota's Medicaid program, covers about 1.3 million people in Minnesota. It's about 23% of our total population, and it provides healthcare services, healthcare coverage, really for our vulnerable populations, our most vulnerable populations based on income, disability, age, is where the enrollees that we focus on are coming from in our communities. That 1.3 million people is distributed fairly equally between the 7-county metro area and greater Minnesota. However, as a percentage of population, greater Minnesota has a higher percentage of people that enroll in our coverage for their healthcare coverage. Combined spending is about $12 billion per year on this coverage, and children and families, as you'll see in the charts on the right, make up the largest category of our enrollee population, but their spending, at least on a per capita basis, is relatively smaller than other categories that have fewer enrollees but higher costs per enrollee. Next slide. As we talk about our spending, or prepare to talk about our spending, want to make sure that people understand that we provide coverage through a couple of different avenues. First is our fee-for-service program. In this program, people that are enrolled in coverage, we have a fee schedule. When they go to the provider provides a service, bills DHS directly, and we pay the fee schedule amount for the services that were delivered to our enrollees. Like I said, that covers about 25% of our population. The other 75% are in managed care. We contract with 8 managed care organizations, or MCOs. We pay them a monthly capitated amount per enrollee, and then they design provider networks, provide care coordination and other care management services to enrollees. They negotiate their own payment rates with providers independently. And so providers, when they are treating someone from our programs that's enrolled in managed care, they bill the managed care organization, and the managed care organization settles that claim with them based on their negotiated payment rate. Within both of these programs, we have a demonstration project called Integrated Health Partnerships, or IHPs. These are contracts that DHS has with healthcare provider organizations that are incentive-based for them on their entire population of Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance enrollees. So regardless of whether or not the enrollee is in fee-for-service or managed care, they are working toward improving the quality of care and lowering the total spending for their enrollees. And if they are able to meet those goals and objectives, they're able to earn financial incentives for that. And so we just wanted to be able to build that picture for you as you're looking at when we're going to be talking about spending, so that you understand the different categories of enrollees and the different types of data that we have available. Next slide, please. So again, in our managed care, we're talking about a prepaid monthly capitation fee per enrollee, and the provider rates are negotiated between the provider and the managed care organization. As a result of this, our data in terms of utilization and spending generally lags the data that we have on our fee-for-service population. The other thing that to emphasize, as I talk about managed care organizations negotiating payment rates with providers, on our fee-for-service program, those rates are set by the legislature, and so that's where the fee schedule comes from. Next slide, please. We have within our managed care programs, we have several categories of populations and different contracts with managed care organizations to serve these populations. The largest by far is the families and children category. Again, almost a million people covered in Minnesota through managed care in the families and children's categories. We also offer managed care for adults with disabilities, a much smaller population, but obviously a more difficult and complex population, medically speaking. And we have our seniors population. These people are predominantly dual eligible, which means that they are enrolled both in Medicare and in Medicaid. So Medicare is the first payer for services. If the person receives services that they aren't eligible to get Medicare benefits for, then Medicaid pays for those. And so as a result, Medicaid is the largest payer for long-term care services in the state, because that's those services are not covered most of the time by Medicare. Also, as we talk about the breakdown of these, I just want to note that adults with disabilities, a larger portion of our enrollees live in the metro area, whereas seniors, larger portion live in greater Minnesota for those that we cover. Next slide. So as we get into the topics, more of the topics for today's discussion, one of the areas we were asked to cover was the enhanced federal match that the state is receiving because of the pandemic. So last spring, Congress passed the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. As part of that bill, it included enhanced funding for states for their Medicaid programs. So again, the Medicaid program is a state and federal partnership. The state pays for the costs of care, and the federal government reimburses a percentage of those costs for our enrollees. The percentage can vary by state. For Minnesota, we are at the low end of the federal match, so we get about 50% in normal times. We get about 50% match from the federal government. If we spend a dollar, the federal government reimburses us 50 cents. Under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, as long as we meet the conditions required, we get an enhanced 6.2% federal match on our Medicaid spending. So instead of spending about 50% of our costs, we spend 38.2%. I'm doing math in my head now. 43.8%. And the federal government pays 56.2% of the costs. As a result, the state is spending less on our Medicaid programs from state funding than was projected during this biennial budget. In order to be able to meet the conditions for receiving this enhanced federal funding, we have to maintain eligibility standards in the same place that they were as of January 1st, 2020. Without adding restrictions. We have to maintain premiums for enrollees who have to pay a premium. That's predominantly our medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, or MAEAPD. And we can't raise premiums for people beyond what they were on January 1st, 2020. We can't propose cost sharing on COVID testing services or treatments, and that includes vaccinations. And then most importantly, we have to provide continuous coverage for people that were enrolled as of March 18th, 2020. So if they were enrolled on March 18th, or they enrolled sometime after March 18th, they continue to stay enrolled with very few exceptions, even if their period of eligibility would have expired, they forgot to submit some documents for their renewal, whatever the case may be. They continue to stay enrolled in our programs. And I said there were a few exceptions. Those are, generally speaking, if they are no longer a resident of Minnesota, if they pass away, or if they ask to be taken off the program, we will honor that request. There are some exceptions that CMS issued after passage of the act related to limited coverage for people who are undocumented, particularly pregnant women after their 2-month postpartum eligibility period, if they are legal residents, can no longer be covered. Likewise, for children over age 21 who are not lawfully present, those are also, they also lose coverage.
November 2nd, CMS issued an interim final rule that contains some additional requirements on states, largely around identifying more aggressively people that are no longer residing in the state, the ability to end coverage if the initial enrollment was due to fraud by the enrollee, for example, and to make changes if we have people that are eligible for a different program with the same benefits, but that would be at lower cost to the state. And those are very limited circumstances, but wanted to mention those for the committee. Next slide, please. So as we look at the impacts of COVID, this is our number of individuals that are enrolled in our healthcare programs. You'll see that the green line is 2020. The blue line is, for comparison, our enrollments in 2019. You'll see that in 2019, very consistent enrollment month over month throughout the year, whereas in 2020, when the peacetime emergency was announced and that Families First Coronavirus Response Act was passed, that's when many people began losing employer-sponsored coverage because of loss of jobs, and our enrollments began to grow swiftly. They are now about 110,000 more people in our programs than at this point in time in 2019. That rate of growth has tended to slow in the past couple of months or at the end of 2020. And that slower rate of growth is also part of the reason for the difference in the economic forecast from MMB between May and the rates of growth expected at that point in time, and then the November forecast and what we really see playing out. Overall, though, enrollments continue to grow, although at a slower pace. Next slide. Conversely, as we look at the applications for enrollment, again, the green line is 2020, the blue line is 2019. And this may be counterintuitive, but we are consistently getting fewer applications per month than we did during 2019. And the reason for that is that policy to maintain continuous coverage. So what you're seeing in this graph is the difference between what we would normally see in a given month is people that lost coverage because their eligibility period ended, they didn't get paperwork in for their renewal, something changed in their life, whatever, they fall off coverage and then have to reapply. So the difference between these two charts is the amount of reapplications that we don't need to process during COVID-19 because people are remaining on the program. They aren't dropping off and therefore don't need to reapply. Next slide. As indicated in Mr. Gildemeister's presentation, we are seeing in the data that we have available at this point, decrease in the rate of growth in services that our enrollees are receiving. Likewise, a decrease in just the raw number of people getting services during COVID-19. Utilization of all services is not necessarily down. So PCA and home health services nationally are up. We think at the end of the year seeing increases in mental and behavioral health services from what we were earlier in the pandemic. But overall, as a general rule, the number of services is down significantly this year and largely due to lack of access. Next slide. This is preliminary data, national data on child screening services, indicating a steep decline during the beginning of the pandemic and then beginning to pull out of that decline a little bit at the end of the spring, but very significant concerns, as was indicated by the earlier discussion with Mr. Gildemeister, around the effects of delayed or missed preventive screenings, diagnostic services, things that normally people would have been receiving and may have been able to identify needs earlier and therefore would be able to be addressed before the condition gets more acute and more costly. And so these are some of these are very concerning indications of perhaps long-term impacts from COVID-19. Next slide. here in Minnesota and a little bit more information on those well child visits. This is, again, comparing 2019 to 2020 over a 9-month period of time. And you'll see that we are significantly below the number of well child visits in our programs. Also important to reflect on this, that this is also with more people being enrolled. So again, we have 110,000 more people enrolled, many of them children, and yet the number of well child services that are being delivered to our enrollees is significantly lower than it was in a normal year. And so these are things that we are tracking and are creating, encouraging our managed care organizations that serve most of those children to really be helping, as well as our delivery system, in being able to try to help get those kids in, make sure that they get their visits. Even if it's late, it's better than missing them entirely. Next slide. Mr. Gildemeister referenced the use of telehealth services. Wanted to provide you with our utilization within our program. So this is not the entire population. This is just Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance. But you'll see that by age group, significant variation in who uses telemedicine and when. And so you'll see, you know, large in that 26 to sort of 55, 65 year old group, large increases in use of telemedicine, and then also in the younger populations. But across the board, just tremendous growth in that early period of the pandemic. Next slide. As we're looking at specific claims and seeing trends in that, this is for our fee-for-service population. So again, that 25% population that we serve, but we see across the board declines in services during the two quarters of COVID that we have data for. These numbers, again, will continue to change, but just want to highlight that they are significant, you know, 25 to 40%. Drops in some of these areas, and also troubling indicators, particularly when you think about mental health needs and those needs during the pandemic and the impact of trauma and isolation, and yet mental health services going down 20% is troubling. Pharmacy utilizations going down, again, recognizing that a lot of the pharmaceuticals are related to behavioral health and chronic disease conditions. Those both may portend for tough times to come in terms of overall health of the population. We will have more utilization trends on managed care organizations. Those numbers and that data for us usually lag our fee-for-service, because we're getting the fee-for-service claims directly. And so we hope to have more information and obviously more complete information about the entire year for you in the months ahead. Next slide. So in terms of spending trends, 2020 spending is still up relative to 2019 spending, but the rate of increase is significantly slower than we had been seeing. Minnesota management and budget forecasts prior to this year had been forecasting, you know, 4 or 5% rate of growth, and consistent with what Mr. Gildemeister was showing over the population as a whole, we're seeing only about a 2.6% rate of growth in spending over 2020 in our programs. The average spending per enrollee is going up, and that is largely because of when they need care, the acuity is higher. Obviously, we have care for a significant number of our enrollees for COVID-related illnesses, and some of that care can be quite expensive because of the need for ICU levels of care. And then also the question marks that are still outstanding about how much care is going to be the result of foregone care that could have been caught earlier, or in a easier to treat time frame. And so a lot of unknowns that remain for our population as to what we can expect, both in terms of the net dollars from 2020, but what to expect in 2021. Next slide, please. One of the ways that states deal with those dramatic uncertainties is to use risk corridors. So we amended our 2020 contracts with managed care organizations, as well as our contracts for 2021, to implement risk corridors. These are used when you have a really unanticipated, unpredictable shift in the market that really changes the landscape of what the parties expected and anticipated at the time that they entered into the contract. So when we contracted with managed care organizations, our actuarial analysis and their actuarial analysis predicted a certain rate of growth and utilization. And then when something like this comes in and throws all of that out of whack, and really the sort of spirit of the deal is not really even present anymore because of the disruption, we put in risk corridors that say, listen, here's what the original expected amount of revenue and loss that a plan should be able to experience in a given year based on its population. And we're going to put risk corridors in saying if the amount of utilization is radically lower than what was expected, and as a result, the managed care organization's spending is lower than expected, the plan is going to repay a portion of that lower spending back to the state to prevent an unanticipated windfall. Likewise, if spending goes radically higher than expected, for example, if COVID-related treatments, vaccine costs, what have you, cause spending to skyrocket well beyond the risk that managed care organizations were expected to take when the contracts were done, a risk corridor is going to say, we're going to stop your losses at a certain point, and the state will repay the managed care plans for that excess spending. So the risk corridors are tied to medical utilization. If utilization goes up much higher than expected, then the state is there to protect the plans from those unexpected losses. If utilization drops much more than expected, then the plans will return spending to the state that would be unanticipated gains. So we have those in place for 2020 and 2021. The difficulty for purposes of forecasting, though, is that the amount that the state would receive, presumably in 2020, we are still making our capitation payments as expected under the contract, and we won't know until later into 2021 how much spending was below or above those risk corridors. And so the forecast, as Mr. Gildemeister outlined, was able to identify the lower spending in our fee-for-service population because those were claims that we've already received or didn't receive, as the case may be. But the managed care side of our business, we will know about in 2021 and therefore could not be part of the forecast. Next slide. Just want to highlight real briefly, this is data from a partnership we have with Minnesota Community Measurement to study and measure disparities by race and ethnicity. These studies have been going on since 2007, and what you'll see is that for our communities of color, and particularly African American or Black Americans and Native Americans, almost on every measure, the disparities are very evident relative to what the majority population receives in terms of health outcomes. And so what we are doing is trying to be more attentive and address these disparities within our programs. So as part of those risk corridor arrangements, we have financial incentives for plans if they, in 2021, if they improve disparities in multiple areas that we are measuring. These are disparities that have been measured for long periods of time, issues around, again, well child visits and vaccinations, cancer screenings, initiating or following up on behavioral health treatment, managing chronic conditions. If they are able to perform better and our enrollees as a result are getting better outcomes, they can benefit financially through those risk corridor arrangements. Next slide. And so we've, again, some of those areas that we identified and that we are tracking and the incentives that are in place, this is an initiative that we're very excited about. And as we look ahead to our next procurements for managed care contracts, hoping to build on that momentum. Next slide. And then just real quickly, just want to give the committee an update that we are in the process of procuring new contracts in the seven county metro area. That RFP was published on January 4th. Just, you know, why do we reprocure contracts? Federal law requires us, if we're going to use managed care in our Medicaid program, that it be done through competitive procurements. State law requires us to reprocure every 5 years. By reprocuring, we're able to ensure that our enrollees are getting higher quality care and the best value than may have been in place 5 years ago, so that we are staying current. And of course, as MMB in its presentation, we are spending more than $5 billion annually through these contracts. There is a significant public interest in making sure that we are managing those contracts and trying to get the best value possible. Next slide.
And Assistant Commissioner, yeah. We have about 9 minutes left in the hearing. We do have one question, so I think you're coming to the end pretty soon here, right?
That's okay. I am, and what I would say is with the time that we have available, I'd be happy to stand for questions. We have the slides and are willing to take questions on the remaining couple of slides, but also any of the previous material, and invite committee members if they have questions after the presentation, and feel free to contact me with those as well.
Okay, and why don't you just really quickly go through the procurement, because I think that's important, and then we'll go to Representative Schultz.
Great. So in this year's procurement, as I said, the first RFP has been issued for the seven county metro area for the children's and families category of enrollees. This was developed. DHS and the Association of Minnesota Counties came together to create a work group to work together with largely with leaders from the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators to try to see how we could do our procurement process differently than we've done before, creating a stronger partnership with counties and really trying to build a procurement process that captures our shared interest for our residents and for our enrollees. So we worked with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and then as we got closer to developing the RFP itself, we created a group with those seven counties to create the RFP, the questions, the scoring methodology, how the scoring is going to be weighted. And we have extended and expect to be doing the scoring together with those counties so that we come out with a shared scoring between the state and the counties. And you'll see if you review the RFP that it really has a strong emphasis on our shared goals of better health, fuller lives, more equitable outcomes, and a lower rate of cost growth for our enrollees. And that process is underway. We have we'll be having a conference with potential responders later this month, and the contract awards will be announced in May. Next slide. Okay. Our schedule. We also have upcoming RFPs for the statewide seniors and special needs populations. Those RFPs will be out in October, and then next January, the RFP for the 80 greater Minnesota counties for their families and children's contracts will go out next January. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and this is for the commissioner. So do we get the enhanced rate for our expansion population in our MA? And second, will you be using the exact same RFP when you do Greater Minnesota? And can you share that RFP with us so we can look at the health outcomes you're using?
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz. Great questions. I hope I can remember all three of them here off the top of my head. So first, excellent question. The enhanced FMAP does not apply to the Medicaid expansion population. Those are adults without dependent children who earn less than 138% of the federal poverty line. The federal government already provides a 90% match on those enrollees. And so Congress did said that the enhanced FMAP would not apply to that percentage. So it's the enhanced FMAP only applies to our other categories of enrollees that normally we would be receiving about a 50% match. Second is, yes, we can absolutely make the RFP. We will send you a link to the RFP so you can review that, see the questions that we're asking, see the where the counties in the state put the scoring weights so you can see where there's emphasis on different areas. And happy to answer your questions about those. And I'm sorry, there's a third question that I can't remember. Blanking on it.
Representative Schultz,
if you were using the same RFP process,
for
a different region,
right, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, thank you. Apologize for that. No, so the RFP was developed with the seven county metros for the metro area. We've reconvened our work group with the Association of Minnesota Counties and are talking with the counties about how we want this process to work going forward. There's a strong interest in making sure that different parts of the state have different needs, different health needs for their enrollees, different challenges that their enrollees face. And so there's a real interest in trying to make sure that we can create RFPs that address some of those local issues. Today, sitting here, I can't tell you exactly how we're going to do that, but we are intending to work with counties to be able to try to build in some of those local needs and local issues into the RFP process. I would expect that there may be some similarities, certainly as issues around behavioral health are pretty similar around the state. But in some parts of the state, issues of behavioral health may have a heavier emphasis on access than in others. Non-emergency medical transportation, very different challenge in really rural communities than they are in the Twin Cities. And so I expect that you'll see differences when the other RFPs are released. The other thing I would say is the ones that are coming out in October, because they're targeted specifically at the seniors population and the population of adults with disabilities, obviously very different needs just for those populations as well. So we're excited about the metro area RFP, but that is not the end of the story by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, thank you. I think we have time for one more question. I think we have one more hand up. Representative Bierman, about 3 minutes left in the hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Anderson, I was just curious, you mentioned the fee-for-service rates are set by the legislature, and I'm wondering how long have the MA rates been set where they are today, and where does Minnesota stand nationwide as far as the level of those reimbursement schedules?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So our fee-for-service rates, it varies by service and when the service was eligible to be covered and when those rates were set. Generally speaking, though, I think it's fair to say that our fee-for-service rates were created decades ago based on information that was decades old at that period of time. And so they have not been fundamentally updated in many, many years. And so there are areas where there is a significant lag over time in terms of what's happened in healthcare markets and where those rates maybe should be in a more ideal situation. Relative to other states, it's very difficult to compare based on what services and offerings are out there. And I can get back to you, ask my peers back at DHS if we have recent studies that compare where those rates are.
All right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Okay. And just to kind of close the circle on that, Commissioner, 75% of our enrollees are actually under managed care, right? This, if I remember Correct. The slide right that you showed. And under managed care, the managed care organizations set their rates. And am I correct in saying that those are considered private? So if I want to say, have you come into the committee and tell me how much does Blue Cross pay a dentist? How much does Health Partners pay a dentist? that we're not allowed to know that. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, yes, that the managed care organizations regard their negotiated rates with providers to be proprietary information and non-public.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your presentation today, Assistant Commissioner Anderson. It's very helpful. There's so much more to say about this. Members, the question I just asked, I just consider it a huge problem that 75% of our enrollees in this enormous program are under MCOs, and we, the legislators who are supposed to be responsible for the spending, are not allowed to know how much they're paying a provider. That's a problem, and one that I would very much like us to do something about. Anyway, that is all we have time for in this hearing. Members, tomorrow we will be hearing from the Department of Health about the vaccine distribution. That should be very topical, and hope to get a good update on that. And appreciate everyone's attendance, appreciate all the good information we got today. And with that, members, we are adjourned.